Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the web, 989fm.com.au or on our podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's great to have your company this morning. Now today our guest comes from way down south, Tasmania. She's living in Tasmania at the moment and is at the University of Tasmania. Claire Anderson, welcome to the program. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you, Amy. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, no, great to have you on the show. Can I start by asking you your mob in your country?
Yeah, my mum is now deceased, but obviously lots of family and our lands are still very much alive and well and being taken care of by, later generations. And our country is up in Queensland, up in the Gulf Country, Gungalita and Yanyuwa land.
Right.
Yeah.
So you actually grew up in the territory, or you spent quite a lot of time in the territory away from your mob.
Yes, in the territory. Because my family was a like an interracial marriage, you know, you can't have black and white people marrying. And that caused a lot of difficulty for my parents. And they found a sanctuary, a safe place, a fresh start in the territory. That's why they left Queensland.
Wow, that's a very interesting story. Did you ever want to go back to your home country?
Oh, yes. Yes, we've been. We've been several times. We've got many relatives who live there.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, I guess that's the great thing. Even though you go, you always got those ties to it.
Yes, and we have many family come and visit us here as well. They love to come to Tassie. So that's good for the young people, you know, to come out and have a complete change. And, of course, they only like to come in the summertime.
I don't think I could do the winter.
Yeah, although some people do come then and enjoy the snow experience and the sleet and the rain.
So what, even the territory, that's a long way from Tassie. How did you end up in Tasmania?
Well, I came here to go to school because I was at primary school there in Tennant. We only had up to grade 7. We had grade 6 and then grade 7 was called progress year, but really there was nowhere to progress to. Unless your family had money and could send you away to boarding school or something, that was when school finished. And I was fortunate enough to come to Tassie. My first job was a farmhand. I worked on a dairy farm up in the northwest coast of Tasmania, and I was able to go to high school during the day. And that happened because I was in the Brownie in Tennant, and the brown owl, she had friends and connections in Tassie, and so that's how that all happened, if you like. And lived with a farm with a family and worked in return for going to school during the day.
Really? So you actually went down to Tasmania by yourself, did you?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I was about 13.
That's 14. Phenomenal. I can't get over it. I mean, what was the...
I turned 14 in that year, yeah.
Wow, I mean, it must have been a huge culture shock for you to go from Tennant Creek to Tassie.
It was wonderful because the brown owl used to have slide night, and she would show us these beautiful, beautiful rainforest pictures, you know, with waterfalls and really lush green country. And I fell in love with it. I just thought it was, you know, the most magical place. It was so different from desert country. I mean, the desert is beautiful too, but, you know, it's beautiful in a different way. When I'm here, I really miss that red earth.
Yeah.
So, it's, you know, I've spent my whole life going between the two.
Right. It's amazing, isn't it?
I go back up there to kind of warm my heart up, if you like, and then I come back again.
Get you ready for winter.
Yeah, that's it.
When you talked about your experiences in Tennant Creek and about that progress here and not having anywhere to progress to, is that why it sort of influenced you to look into education in your career?
Definitely, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I find that education has helped all of my family progress with their lives. work our way out of poverty. And I think a lot of other families haven't had that opportunity. You know, all of us came here. My brothers and sisters eventually came down when my parents passed away, came and lived with me. They all went to year 12, have all had, further training and careers. You know, we've got early childhood workers, we've got teachers, we've got tax assessors and public servants. And they have all got those jobs through completing up to year 12, really.
It's sad,
and then
though.
Going on.
Yeah, no, because I was going to say it's really sad that not everyone has those opportunities. I mean, in Tennant Creek, has much changed, I guess, in that way?
I think they do now have a full high school experience. I'm not sure whether they have, year 11 and 12, but they certainly have up to grade 10. And I'm not sure what they, what else they've got. But with technology, distance learning is so much richer now than it used to be when, we had, children, what was it called? Something over the air.
School over the air or school of the air or something like that.
School of the air, yeah. So some of the people who lived out of town had access to that, if they were living out on the cattle stations and that.
Right.
I think it's very difficult, but a lot of those kids had to go to boarding school. And unless you've got, kids went to Mount Isa, they went to Adelaide, they went to Melbourne, and some went down to Alice. I think there were some at some areas there. There was a bit of a boarding facility. But unless your family could support you to do that, there wasn't an option.
Yeah, it's really sad. I mean, do you think there's going to be a situation where it changes, where, education is going to be supported within communities?
I would love to see that. But the only way it can really happen is if we educate people from those communities and then they can go back, and do that. Be the educators in that place, be the nurses, be the doctors, even the hairdressers, labourers, workers. Unless you've got the skill set, it's very difficult.
Yeah, and I guess even just to see a future, like if you got to a situation where, you have a progress year and there's nowhere to go, I mean, it's very hard to see that future in front of you if it hasn't been there or denied.
I think it limits your aspirations, definitely. I mean, if you look around you, I know when I was there, some of the girls left and had babies pretty quickly after leaving school and started families. Other people got jobs, at the hotel on the reception or as cleaners or, in the shop, shop assistant. But really, in a small town, there's limited opportunities. And for me, I saw I had to get out. I mean, I saw what the opportunities were. I had worked in a shoe shop. I had worked in a milk bar. I'd worked in the pub on the reception there, booking people into their rooms. I think I also mentioned I worked at the picture theatre selling ice cream. I mean, I didn't want to keep doing that forever.
Yeah.
I wanted to do something else, and the only way to do that was to keep going and, keep going to school.
So you've had about 3 decades experience in this education sector, haven't you? I mean,
I have. And I can see over that time enormous change has happened. And that's as a result of, people like myself lobbying, to create opportunities and make it easier for people to either move away from, move away from home and have some scholarships, to go to school.
What do you think are the barriers still in place, do you think?
Oh, lots of barriers. I mean, even though we might have students coming here to uni and receive a scholarship, they still struggle because it doesn't absolutely sustain them. In our centres we provide, some cooking facilities and often put on meals. There's at least bread and Vegemite and peanut butter. There's something you can have to eat and make a cup of tea or coffee. So you can, some of the students really struggle with food and just transport. And if you've got other family responsibilities, it's really impossible,
to
support your family and study.
Mm. I think I saw some statistics as well, like the retention of Aboriginal students in higher education particularly. I mean, there's a real gap between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal students, isn't there still today?
There still is, yes. We've improved our retention to Year 12 across the country. But once they get into a course, it's still very challenging for them, mainly because of these extra family obligations, you know. And one of the big things are there are many deaths in Aboriginal families, and so it's a lot of grieving,
yep.
You know. And there's costs associated with burials as well that families have to contribute to. And just being, you know, really miserable.
Yeah.
It's very hard. You know, in the wider community, people might have one or two deaths. They might lose a grandparent, you know, during their, or, you know, or someone in their family might have a, you know, car accident or something, and that's a terrible loss too. But for Aboriginal families, they're losing, you know, you can have a funeral every 3 months,
yep.
Every 4 months. You know, there's lots of deaths each year of important people, you know, in your immediate family. Yeah.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's very hard to keep going, I guess, when you're dealing with that trauma on top of the stress of, you know, a workload.
Yeah, study and just organising your life.
Yeah. Yes,
I think it does make it very difficult. And I think everything that we can do to support students, in the long term, it's a really good investment, because not only are you helping that individual, you'll help that extended family as well. Because I know that's true in my case. You know, I got a good education. I was able to support my brothers and sisters to come through as well. And then with my own children, you know, they've all gone to university and they all have degrees. Some of them are on to their second degree. You know, so it really is about investing in people, and
yeah.
They're making great contributions, you know, in their workplaces.
Do you think there's enough, I mean, it's underfunded everywhere in Aboriginal affairs. Is that a black spot as well, the funding? Do you think governments see the value in it? Like, I'm just thinking of the ITAS program being defunded particularly. Mm. But have you seen that maybe it's being devalued from a government perspective?
Not necessarily. I think there are lots of demands on the government. I think the new arrangements, the new funding arrangements, there's been a lot of consultation about it. And the money isn't lost, but, you know, it's gone into the pool, and students will be able to be supported to have tutorial support. It just won't be in the same way that it was before. The old system was very rigid, and we couldn't actually support any students who wanted to do some postgrad work, you know. So now we'll be able to support them in their undergraduate studies, so when they first come in, as well as through, you know, further on if they want to do some more studies. Because it's not just about getting that first degree now. You know, the world's moved on. People now need more qualifications, not just the entry level. So, you know, we have to support people to keep going. Mm.
Yeah, it's very interesting topic, and hopefully I can talk to you more about it a bit later. But I was really interested in this map that the University of Tasmania have actually launched. Can you tell me a little bit about how, you know, sort of the origins of this map?
Okay, well, we got the money to develop the map from, the university has a program called Community Engagement, and so you can apply to that fund, Community Engagement Fund, for a project that involves community, right, in the project. So I liaised with a few Aboriginal groups here, and we applied for some money. I think it was $12,000. It wasn't a very, very big amount of money. And we set up a reference group and we had a look at how we could make this map, because I had a little dream that with the technology, when tourists or school teachers wanted to look up information, you can find this information by searching. You know, if you put the topic into Google, but you've got to know the topic,
yeah.
Right? So you've got to know what you're looking for when you put it in there for it to search. And so what we've done is just taken lots of stuff that's already in the public domain, and using this computer program called ARGIS, which is a geographical resource, we put all of the stuff that's already in the public domain into that resource. And so it's interactive. So, and it's connected to this map. But you could have maps of lots of places in Australia. What I would love to see is an Australia-wide map like this.
Yeah.
So no matter where you went, you could click on it, you could find traditional owners, of that place, and you could find out lots more about that local community. And it would be really helpful for our students. So we send our nurses on placement, we send our doctors on placement, our social workers. And if they knew where they were going and could find out a little bit about that place, that would be terrific. At the moment, there's nothing really Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander in that information that's out there.
Which is really ironic because it's obviously Aboriginal land.
It's our country. Our country, and there's very little there about it. There are some communities that have got really good websites, you know, and there are some organisations that have really good websites about what they do. But unless you know what you're looking for, it's very hard to find it. Whereas this map, at least this one, Aboriginal Tasmania, the heading's there, and we've promoted it quite broadly. We hope that the tourists, when they come, will access it and, you know, look at things as they go around the country. And as well, just public servants and school teachers, it will just make the information a lot more accessible for them.
It's really interesting because when you think of Tasmania and you hear about people who go down, and I've never been, I've always wanted to go to Tassie, but when you hear about it, people go to all the white, you know, the really colonial heritage, or they go to the museum, and they have no idea
A lot of that.
Yeah.
It's very present in the landscape and very present in your psyche when you drive around. You know, you can see the historical ruins, that colonial presence is very strong in the landscape, but the Aboriginal presence is also there. It's just about identifying it and making it accessible to people. Yeah,
it's very it's a really great map. I loved the start where you click through the clan groups. I thought that was really interesting to see it as the different Aboriginal nations within Tasmania.
Absolutely, and lots of people who've lived here all their lives, they don't know any of that.
Yeah,
you know. They haven't had a chance to learn it. And I'm hoping that this, you know, that this information will become much more accessible, as I said, for kids growing up, you know, throughout their schooling years, they can explore. When they go on their holidays with mum and dad, they can have an explore as well. And it's not complete. You know, we can keep adding things as people identify new things that we can add to it.
Is it something that you would have liked when you first moved down to Tassie?
I would have loved it, yes.
Was it hard for you to find that Aboriginal history? Yeah,
it was definitely because I came here in 1967. Right, we'd just had the referendum, and there was a real lack of acknowledgement of the Aboriginal people in Tasmania. In fact, I think they were still perpetuating that myth, you know, that there were no Aborigines here, and of course there were.
Yeah,
it's just that they didn't really have a high profile. In those early days. But as people like Michael Mansell, you know, set up his organisation, and that organisation has grown over time and delivers, you know, a whole range of health and legal services and housing support and youth programs. I mean, the range of support that's been provided is wonderful, but it also has that education role, making people aware of the community and what the community is trying to achieve for itself. You know, as it buys back land and sets up enterprises, and it's very proactive and responsive, and they're great advocates. I really admire the achievement.
I was just going to say, when you talk about the myth, like even I was, I graduated 2006, but I think in grade 8 or grade 9, the teacher said, "Put up your hand if you've ever met a Tasmanian Aboriginal person," and I'd never met, you know, countrymen from Tasmania. So I didn't no one put up their hand. And he said, well, you know, if you had, you're wrong, because they're all massacred and there was a genocide in Tasmania. That's what I was taught in school. So,
yeah,
I mean,
I know. I mean, they can only teach what they were taught. And I think it suited the government in a way, and the newspapers and whoever else, to perpetuate that story rather than become informed and not give any credence or credibility to the community who has always been here. I mean, they've always known who they are, which families, and have supported each other. And, you know, they've achieved some really great things, you know, like land hand back has been really, really important, getting back ancestral remains from around the world. Yeah, they've really led the way.
They have. That's what's great about actually looking back and seeing how they have led those fights. It's actually really phenomenal when you consider that. The other thing that was interesting with the story map is how do you think it can help sort of help, I guess, promote that importance of protecting cultural heritage? Because I think that's the other fight in Tasmania is that the government just continues to ride roughshod over Aboriginal heritage, and there's this constant threat to that heritage.
Yeah, and I think we just have to keep on with that battle. But educating people about the value of these sites is really important, because I think that's the only way you're going to stop the destruction of sites. You know? They have to go hand in hand. The lobbying to change legislation is really important, and there are people, you know, working to achieve that. But I think if we can work on the kids in schools, you know, there are some ratbags out there whose minds we probably will never change. But yeah,
that's true. We always got to try.
Yeah, definitely.
What's your favourite, I guess, when you're looking through the map? I guess, where's your favourite place to learn about in Tasmania?
I think I like the French Connection. Yeah, you know, the East Coast. It's beautiful there, absolutely idyllic, you know, wonderful beaches. And there's also that French and Aboriginal connection, and also down the south as well. You know, I think those early contacts were friendly. You know, there was a true exchange of cultural knowledge, if you like, and then, you know, things went awry after that.
Yeah, and it seems to be the case of it, first contact all across a lot of the cases all across the country, where the first contact was like the knowledge exchange, and then the massacres started happening as settlers, the invaders sort of came in and tried to take land and everything like that. So.
Yes, well, I guess initially that was just a visit, and so things were, you know, probably on safe ground, if you like. But later on, once you know, trying to take over the country, then it's a different story.
So where else are you supposed to, are you hoping to expand this map? I guess what next? Is it a finished product, or you're hoping to keep evolving it?
Yeah, no, we'll keep building it as people give us new information, you know, because events, history is not a thing that happens, you know, and stops. We're making history the whole time, you know, with important events and achievements. So those things will go in there as they're achieved. And as we make new discoveries as well, there might have been events from the past that come to light, and we will include those as well. Because you know, archaeology, there's a lot of discovery going on all the time. And, you know, once we know about that and the evidence is explained, then we can include that as well.
I really liked the focus also on, I think there's that perception that Aboriginal history is in the past, whereas I liked the real modern aspects to it as well, like the bridge
walk. And,
yeah, those were really great additions, I thought.
Yeah, and the contemporary communities and what they're doing in their local places, you know, whether they're running a health service or setting up a farm, or there's a new one that just got in touch the other week about a bush tucker trial.
Oh, great.
You know, or trail, so you can go through and do the walk, and that'll be up near Deloraine. So, you know, as people start new projects, we would like to showcase those as well, because I think there is this perception that when visitors come here that there is no... there's nothing Aboriginal you can do.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
No, where can they go and what can they see? And so this can help people plan their tour as well. They can say, oh, yes, I'm going to go to the northeast, and I'm going to do that walk, or, you know, I'm going to look at that site, or, you know. They will know a little bit before they actually get on the country.
Yeah, yeah.
And they'll certainly know whose country they're entering, which is really important as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you can ask, if you asked any random Australian, you asked him if you know any, you know, Aboriginal nation, there'd be very few who would be able to tell you many nations, would they, or any languages?
No. There's a huge knowledge gap. I mean, it's quite different. Like if you travel and you go, say, to America, they're very well informed about the native Americans and, you know, whose lands they're on. And if you go to New Zealand, the Maori are very proactive, you know, at claiming and putting up signs about, you know, whose territory you're entering now, whose land you're on. I just think there's a lot of work that we can do to heal and to build bridges, you know, and share knowledge. I mean, Australia has a very rich history, and it's not like, as I said, it's in the past, and people are still living on country, and there's a lot of people who know about what happened there or what's planned, you know, what they've got planned for the future. And it can only help us get on better together if we can understand each other.
Yeah, break through that amnesia, I think, is really important.
Definitely.
That was Professor Claire Anderson from the University of Tasmania. But she's up from the Gulf country up in Queensland and has been living in Tassie since she was a teenager, back and forth between there and Tennant Creek, and had a very interesting story. But the University of Tasmania have launched a really great Tasmanian Aboriginal story map. And you can actually go there and basically have a tour of the Aboriginal history down there. And I think it's a really great project. I was talking to a lot of people have been to Tasmania, and unfortunately I've never been there. But it sounds like a really beautiful place. And I think if I ever wanted to go, I would really want to try and access a lot of that black history first. So if our listeners want to see that, if you're planning to go to Tassie, or if you're just interested, I think there is sort of a basis for these sort of projects to be wound out around the country, I think. But you can actually go to http://www.utas.edu.au/Aboriginal-Tasmania-story-map. And we'll put that up on the website as well if you want to check it out. We might go for a break and we'll be back later with more Let's Talk.
You're listening to Let's Talk with Amy McQuire on 98.9 FM.
Good morning. Welcome back to Let's Talk, where my guest this morning was Professor Claire Anderson from down at the University of Tasmania, and we're talking about a project that they've done down there around an Aboriginal story map of Tasmania. So I really encourage you fellas to go check it out, and we'll also put the details up on our website. Now, we have a bit of time left this morning. I thought we'd discuss, I guess, an interesting opinion piece, I guess, to camera on the project last night by Waleed Ali. I'll play a little bit of it.
2016 has been a nightmare. Terror attacks, murders, riots, sexual assaults, corruption, famine, natural disasters. We're all reacting the same way, with fear. Because there's no more natural response when you sit down and watch the news and you're hit with these images over and over and over. We're told the world is scary, and it is. And I've been thinking about it, though, and I can't escape the thought that how we deal with our fear is becoming the defining measure that determines us as a people. Awful news leads to fear, which leads to an outrageous statement, which leads to a pile-on, which leads to a hardening of positions. I kind of feel like we're on a gravitron. We're spinning round and round, and no one's interested in getting off. We're all in this cycle, and as the year wears on, it's just spinning faster and faster, and we're all pushed to the edges, and it becomes harder and harder, like it takes superhuman strength for us to meet in the middle. And eventually, someone's sick, and this is what that looks like.
Personally, I think Andrew Bolt has a point here, that there is a correlation between the number of people who are Muslim in a country and the number of terrorist attacks. Now, I have a lot of very good friends who are Muslim, who are peace-loving, who are beautiful people, but there are fanatics. And does the population and the correlation between those two things, is it having an impact? I mean, if you look at Japan, Japan has a population of 174 million. It has 100,000 people in that country who are Muslim. We never hear of terrorist attacks in Japan. Personally, I would like to see it stop now for Australia because I want to feel safe.
Just to clarify, Sonia, are you saying that you would like our borders closed to Muslims at this point?
Yes, I would.
Now, I could sit here and pull apart Sonia Kruger's statement. I could point out that Japan's had its share of terror attacks, or that the UN has attributed Japan's low crime rate to low inequality and low gun ownership. I could point out that if Sonia's afraid, then logically, as a woman in Australia, she has a much higher chance of being murdered by a man she knows than a Muslim from another country. And I could do all that with the best of intentions, but really, all I'd be doing is encouraging the inertia of outrage that spins the gravitron that we're all on. I'd be fueling the same cycle that has led to absolutely horrendous personal attacks on Sonia in the last 24 hours. Sonia Kruger's not evil. She's scared, and she's trying to make sense of the world. And yesterday, she admitted to not feeling safe. How do you think she feels now? And how do you expect her to react? It's this cycle of legitimate fear that's met with hostility or derision that's led to more than 500,000 Australians voting for Pauline Hanson 2 weeks ago. These people are seeing the same images that you are, and this is their way of finding safety. And when we attack them, we spin the gravitron and everyone's pushed further to the edge. My point is that we're all now responsible for how this story is going to play out. And so I just want you to consider this. When we're presented with an outrageous opinion, we're actually presented with two options: destruction or construction. We can react emotionally and carelessly and with little genuine critical thought, and we can destroy a perceived enemy in the hope that we'll neutralise the threat that's making us feel unsafe. That's the destructive option. Or we can do something that's much more difficult than that. When we're presented with something that we perceive to be an outrageous opinion, we can consider what motivated that person, try to understand their fear, and then empathise with how they came to their conclusion. Because the truth is that what motivates them is fear, and fear is the one thing we're all sharing.
So that was Waleed Ali on the project last night, responding to comments and the ensuing outrage from the remarks Sonia Kruger made on the Today Show this week, basically supporting Andrew Bolt, the well-known racist and bigot, and promoted in Herald Sun and Sky News and a host of other mainstream media outlets, but who cries out that he's a martyr of free speech all the time, even though he's got the most free speech in the country, I would say, and the biggest media microphone. But she was agreeing with him that we need to ban Muslim immigration in the wake of the terrorist attacks in Nice. And basically what Waleed Ali said last night on the project, that it's time that we stop being outraged, that we get off this metaphorical gravitron and start being constructive and start understanding what motivates people to have these racist views. And I mean, I can sort of understand that point, but I'd be interested in hearing what a lot of you mob have to say about it, because I fundamentally disagree. I think that the history of this country has been based upon what the views of racists want and what they want to think. And I think that the outrage is justified. And I don't think that we can deny people their outrage, because the people who are justifiably angry are the people who policies like Pauline Hanson and opinions like Andrew Bolt and Sonia Kruger's ultimately affects. And I think it's actually quite a dangerous opinion to espouse on a mainstream media platform like The Project from a supposedly progressive voice like Waleed Ali's. I think we should be able to get up and be angry, because otherwise people aren't going to listen. You can empathise as much as you want with people like Pauline Hanson, with people like Andrew Bolt. It's not going to change the structures that promote, that entrench, and that continue racism in this country. It's not going to do anything, really. In fact, it's going to further this really horrendous sort of time we're in which it's okay. It's suddenly okay for people like Andrew Bolt to be published and to espouse these really Islamophobic views. And I think we have to remember that, you know, this directly affects a lot of our Muslim brothers and sisters, particularly our Muslim sisters. We saw, I think last year or the year before, every time there is a attack overseas, predominantly women are the ones who, because I guess they're more visible, they're the ones who actually are targeted and victimised much more than someone like Sonia Kruger. I think it's amazing that we're in a time when the power imbalance is so skewed and the media lens is so foggy that we lose sight of who's the powerful and who's the powerless in this equation. So I'd be interested in what people think about Waleed Ali's statement, because on the surface it seems like a nice, happy, oh yeah, we have to forgive the racists. But I think that's a dangerous opinion. I think we shouldn't have to forgive. I think we have to start pushing for change, and that change involves racists owning up to the fact that their views should not be held in a society where we're trying to progress right now. If you're serious about racism, if you, for example, if you're going to NAIDOC marches, if you walk the bridge for reconciliation, you got to understand that, you know, the racism that Muslims are facing right now is, you know, the same racism that was founded in this country through the theft of land, through the dispossession of Aboriginal people. It all comes from the same sort of structures. And I think that's an important point to make. But I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts. That's my thought. That's my opinion. But if you want to have a say, definitely check out our Facebook page. So if you type into Facebook, Let's Talk 98.9, you'll be able to find us there, and just leave a comment or listen back to the podcast and let me know And also you can find us on Twitter if you search 989fm.com.au. You should be able to find it, or of course on our website, or just send me an email at amy@989fm.com.au, because I think it's important. This is what Aboriginal media is about, is to counteract a lot of these mainstream viewpoints that sort of let a lot of people off the hook. And I think particularly in Queensland, obviously, we're at a time when, you know, quite a lot of people voted for a party like One Nation. So I think it's something that we have to confront.